Well, hi, this is Dave. I hope you're all doing okay. Take care of yourselves. I appreciate the responses and the kind words and the questions that you've sent in. I want to try to respond to a kind of theme of questions that I think are really important, and I agree with you about the importance of applying this to your professional practice and how you can recommend your professional fees and how you can get what you're worth. So I want to make a couple of comments, and this combines two or three questions. I need you guys to mute, if you would, *6 until you're ready to talk. If not, I'll put myself on lecture mode, but I'd rather keep it open if you'll manage the background noise. One thing that is important to consider is framing about how price provides a context of value, especially in areas that we don't know much about what an absolute value is. For example, a $100 shirt marked down to $60 provides at least some context of value, that the $100 is an initial frame of value, an anchor. So this is something that we have to think about in terms of professional coaching, because there is a whole spectrum of things out there about different fees that that people charge. We logically know the prices, that prices shouldn't affect performance or value or pleasure, but they do. We make decisions emotionally. This part of our brains make decisions way faster than the logical intellectual brain. And a framework determines meaning. Remember the study that I mentioned from the Wharton School of Business, and the primary thing that determines whether someone will sign on or decline your professional services, and that's the clarity and the confidence that you have when you make your professional recommendation and engage with someone. So get in a state of mind where you feel fully confident about what you're going to say. And I want to focus specifically, and some questions have sort of centered around this, and I think it's a really important aspect. Let's say you do a brief telephone consultation with somebody who's a new client, and you decide you're going to make a recommendation for professional coaching, or you do a sample session and make a recommendation. This is where I want to focus, because I think it makes so much difference about how you make that recommendation. Think about other professionals and the kind of ways that they make recommendations, because I want to use that as a model. Now, the analogy is not pristine, because all the other professionals are a consultancy model, and we're a collaborative one, but I want to focus on the model of the professional making a recommendation, a doc, a dentist, an attorney, a CPA, a financial professional. You go in, you talk about some things, the professional asks you questions, and then there's a recommendation. So this is where I want to come in. This part of the sample session, for example, that you've saved maybe 3 or 4 minutes to make your recommendation. So be sure you're in a state of mind for the entire consultation or sample session where you feel confident about what you're going to say. Remember, there are three story components. Every coaching session will have three story components: the challenge, the development, and the resolution. Think about how that corresponds with the simple coaching model, where you get a client to look at what they want to focus on, where they want to get to. You develop that, and then you come to a resolution of what they're going to do, how they put that into action for action steps. So these three story components can configure every coaching session you have, but let's look at the end, at your recommendation. Same three components, I'm going to suggest, are part of your recommendation at the end. The challenge, the development, and the resolution. That always makes a complete story, and your recommendation should be a complete story. So, here's one way that I would suggest putting that together at the end of a sample session to make a recommendation that's clear, specific, and confident, just as any other professional would. Here's one example of that. We've discussed an aspect, and this assumes a sample session. We've discussed an aspect of a broader issue that seems really important for you right now. I think you have immense potential to make what you do in the immediate future make a difference for the rest of your life. Here's what I would recommend: that we work together in mentor coaching, that we establish a standing time each week of 50 minutes for you to call me. I'm going to send you two things. One, a client information packet. I'd like you to fill that out and get it back to me before our first scheduled session. And a link for payment of monthly retainer that covers all of our sessions for the month, whatever resources and material that I send you, and communication in between time. My monthly retainer is whatever you decide it is. Think about how this is the three-part structure: the challenge, the development, and the resolution. That's what every story has as basic components. Your recommendation for professional services needs to be that, needs to be a complete story. You don't have to justify. You don't have to try to sell yourself. You don't look at defending your fee or explaining what coaching is about. You simply make your recommendation. So, any thoughts or questions about that? Is that making sense to you? Yes, no, maybe? Anyone?
Yes, absolutely yes.
Are there
yes.
Any follow-up questions? Thank you for the response. Keeps me from getting lonely here. are there any questions or comments about any aspect of that?
So I just want to clarify that I captured it. So I have, first, I think, you know, I'd like to make a recommendation. And the first thing I'd like to recommend is that we work together in the going forward to solve whatever the pain point was, and then create solutions to help you get to where you want to be, and I'd have to finesse that. The second one would be working together in weekly sessions. The third would be I'm going to send you an agreement that identifies what we've decided or how we decide to work together going forward. I'll send you a link for the payment, and then I'll send resources, and we'll agree upon, you know, communication, emails or phone calls, texts or whatever. And then finally, my fees for this. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. I want to recommend and to tweak. I want to recommend that you do that in about half as many words in three simple sentences. One sentence each for the challenge, the struggle, the resolution. Remember, keep it simple. The rules of good writing, good speaking, because it's what we retain and attend to: clarity, brevity, and simplicity. So the challenge, I would suggest thinking about saying something about what we've discussed is an indication of a broader and significantly important aspect of your life or your business. That's the challenge. And you've already done the sample of that and addressed something specifically that represents a broader issue. Then you can make your recommendation and what that would look like in very simple ways. Now, one thing that you want to be sure you do, because the anchor that you establish for the value that you bring is your fee. In an area like professional coaching, there's a broad range of possibilities. And think about it in this way. We've talked about this before, but I want to illustrate. Let's assume we can go back to restaurants again someday. You go into a really nice restaurant. The average entrees are $17 to $24. You see one item. Remember, we touched on this before. You see one item, lobster, at $5.95. What do you think? What's the matter with the lobster? I come to your door and say, hey, I've got this brand new BMW 540 I'll let you have for $4,000. What's the matter with you, Kruger, or what's the matter with the car? Relative value is what you bring when you value your services. I would contend, and I've seen this again and again in mentor coaching with a number of people, I don't think you can bring a full value and benefit to your client unless you charge a full fee. Because the client's not going to value it. You'd be wondering the whole time, the hell's the matter with this lobster? Okay, I want to move into what we should be talking about, but we can certainly come back to this. And remember, we're going to tag on 10 or 15 minutes at the end of our final seminar next week at the top of the hour to go over a bit, to just have a discussion about anything that you want to talk about or look at that we didn't get to.
Okay.
Okay, we're in presentation mode now. We're going to talk in this seminar about writing new software. And these are the steps 4 and 5. Decide what to change and map changes of your new money story. We've discussed the concept of your money story, your relationship with money, and the first 3 steps of change, how to recognize, own, and assess your money story. In this seminar, we're going to discuss the next 2 steps. So step 4, decide what to change in your money story. Remember the study I mentioned in our discussion of Ben Fletcher, University of Hertfordshire in the UK, devising a study to get people to break their usual habits. And each day, someone would choose one of 2 options of contrasting behaviors, lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, and behaved accordingly. Additionally, twice weekly, they stretched to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would read something twice a week that they had never read before and eat something twice a week they had never eaten before. The biggest change in the group, recall, was that after 4 months, the subject, this is a large number of people in this study, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. When they were followed over the next 6 months, almost everyone kept the weight off and almost everyone continued to lose weight. And the researchers were baffled. This had nothing to do with diet or weight or eating. But what happened, as they came to see, requiring people to change routine behavior made them actually aware of decisions, of specific choices they made, rather than just on the default mode of doing things automatically. They became aware that every bit of their behavior, every one of their choices, all the way down to every bite of food that they took, was a choice. So they began to reflect, is this bite in my best interest? So once becoming aware of actively making choices, you can decide to make the most informed and strategic choices possible. This is choice architecture. This is what we specialize in as coaches. And remember, your identity is not your behavior or habits. A habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. if you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will make it harder to change. So every action is a choice. Every thought and feeling is a choice. Remember last seminar we discussed the equation, belief drives behavior drives performance. For this step, decide what to change, I want to add another equation. It captures the principle that you either create your reality or you agree to it. And here's the equation. This is in your outline. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience is a result of what you create in your life. Achievement is an outcome. It's a response in a certain way. Remember this essential principle for ownership of your money story. In adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, so now your business is slumping. You've spent more than you've earned, so you now have debt. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset with its own text. And this is how that can sound. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I can't do it. The absence of awareness of choice limits possibility. And here's a footnote and kind of an addendum. Whatever you're doing that you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior such as spending beyond your means, or to a process such as debt, a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results. Money is energy. Anyone addicted to anything has difficulty regulating energy. So here's another notion to consider. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. To say that a little bit differently, show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter, I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. In other words, rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. It's there when you create it. Consider your using your energy to create something else instead. Now, there's a secret embedded here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it seems to make it safe to want it if you're afraid. Here's an example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. The next frame showed the cat, which was at least as big as the dog, not too shabby, really looked ferocious itself. All of a sudden, in the middle of a ferocious bark, the leash snapped. So the dog was free to go after the cat. The dog suddenly panicked, looked astonished, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark his fiery, just let me at him. Now, here's another example of this dialectic of obstacle and desire. When viewing a scene in a film you don't want to see, you cover your face with your hands as if to say, no, I don't want to look. But then desire creeps in and you peek through your fingers at what you're drawn to see. The obstacle makes looking acceptable. Or when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, I can't find time to exercise. I can't put away any savings. Reflect on the underlying desire. And here's the coaching principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. The primary obstacles that people give for not participating in, let's say, retirement plans may include fear of finances, inertia, procrastination, because of other pressing financial demands. But the way you frame an issue makes a great deal of difference. Here's an example. when companies automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings plan, the employee then has to opt out to not participate, to actually make a choice to say, I will not save for my future. When it's automatic, it's 100% initially, then it levels to between 86 and 94% of people save for their retirement. At companies where it's not automatic and someone has to initiate to choose to opt in, 20% participate, over a four-fold difference. And it's just a matter of how it's framed. Now, the huge non-secret here, you can set up your own automatic contributions to set up in a one-time decision, automatically transferring X amount of money from your checking account to your retirement plan every month, automatically. A one-time choice that can make a big difference for the rest of your life. So, let's talk about change and the brain, because this is important to understand when we engage change, because both our minds and brains, each in their own way, automatically resist change. So, let's first look at how the brain opposes change so that we can talk about and use this information to facilitate success in yourselves and in your clients. Number one, these are ways that the brain opposes change. Number one, people have prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. We think that giving somebody new information is all that's necessary to change their minds, but just the opposite occurs. They dig in more solidly to find data that fits their beliefs. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge, but you have to know what someone knows and believes, because that's an anatomical reality in their brain, and you don't just suddenly change that and overwrite what's already there by offering a new fact. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. So this is another aspect of that, that facts and beliefs are anatomical realities. So you can't just present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network in your client's brain. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. So, as we mentor and co-create change, we need to start where the client is, not where we are. And people are not always aware of their prior knowledge. And four, when changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, new connections are made in the brain. New maps begin to be created. So let's look now, and this is more directly important for the strategy we use, how the brain opposes change. The brain has a mind of its own, so we need to consider how our brains work in order to strategically plan change. Each of these precepts, these principles, can help you craft a new money story and to facilitate change in your clients. One. Change generates discomfort. Anything that we've repeated that have become habits become hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brains have become etched by repeated habits because the brain creates efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about the way we drive the same way, say, to work each day. Because of this default mode, we think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is the very energy-efficient brain that frees you up to do other things. When these habits, though, that have become hardwired because they become repeated, have to change, the automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default habit, not because it's logical, but because it's more comfortable. It's our default mode. and it's become synonymous with our identity. More about that later. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expressions. Beliefs turn genes off and turn them off. Ray Kurzweil, I heard him discussing some of his concepts and heard him say this. It's in The Singularity is Near When Humans Transcend Biology. This is from Ray Kurzweil. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. And one of the great philosophers of the 21st century said this even more simply. I like things you don't have to think about. That was George Costanza. Two, change creates dissonance. We see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. The brain has this innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors. The error detection mechanism, the difference between expectation and what we actually perceive, and it registers as the sense that things aren't right. So, a portion of our medial frontal cortex has the job description to recognize and correct errors. So, for example, consider the emotional expense of debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is you have to pay more for it. Then, the emotional expense of your mind and dissonance in your brain to recognize that spending is different from affording. Then you have to pay the interest, triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now, the good news, this neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior by responding to mistakes. So this is great if we remember to determine whether it's a mistake or simply a neural response to change itself, the natural resistance, in other words. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. Let me give you some numbers. If you have a pen or pencil and a piece of paper, I want to give you some numbers. One, two, four, five, seven, eight. What's missing? Most often answers, maybe three and six, multiples of three. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of six numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs two times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up two quarters in a row, the brain predicts a third rise will follow. Here's a real-life example. A company increased profits 26 quarters in a row and projected earnings growth to 24 cents per share for the current quarter. They announced instead earnings of 23 cents a share. They only missed it by a penny. In the next 5 minutes after that announcement, they lose $1.5 billion in market value. So what changed in those 5 minutes? The company's intrinsic value and balance sheet, because they missed it a penny, or the mindset of the investors? J. Paul Getty said that there are three key elements of getting rich. Take some notes here. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of a lot of jokes, listing two things, then a third non sequitur. Set up, payoff. The human brain automatically infers patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge at times to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. We need to be sure that we predict, that we envision the right things. 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? Well, the answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short time but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. This is another way of saying we get what we focus on. Whether it's positive or negative, we get what we focus on. And we assume people are going to receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Well, not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. My next to last post was about the boomerang effect and the current economy, emphasizing how the smarter somebody is, the more they will oppose something new or different that's presented, even factual, and come away being more entrenched. 5, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. This is one of the common things that I hear in Coach the Coach, in training. Well, I just need to get motivated to work out. I need to get motivated to lose some weight. I need to get motivated to do a better diet. That's not necessary. I work with pro athletes and actors. They aren't motivated to get up and go to the gym every day, but they do it simply because they know that that's what they need to do in order to do what's next. Here are the only 2 things that you need, and you know this as coaches, a plan and to stick to it. Look at the system to know what the next step is, to create a map and stick to that plan. You don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. In the example I gave, you make one good decision, and it becomes automatic. You don't have to decide every month. You don't have to be motivated to do it. You made one decision. 6, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, the brain chemicals dopamine and adrenaline are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and reflexively with reflection, assessing knowledge. That's why self-talk is limited. Because as soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. And you've heard this, I know. One of the great philosophers of the 20th and 21st century actually put this really simply. Everybody's got a plan till they're punched in the mouth. That was Mike Tyson. When there's a possibility of a reward, dopamine is released to produce an excited state in response to anticipation of a reward. A risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine or a blackjack table. So here's what we know now. It's not the reward that causes the spike in dopamine. It's the anticipation of reward. When gamblers were studied and hooked up to an fMRI, their increased brain firing and dopamine spike was just before they ever touched the slot machine. And secondly, the less predictable a reward is, the longer and stronger the dopamine neurons fire, creating more of a natural high. This is facts made for slot machine makers and operators. And remember from college, if a laboratory mouse is given regular, predictable reward for running a maze and pushing a lever, as soon as the food pellet reward stops, the behavior pretty soon stops. There's no point in it. But if the food pellets are infrequent and unpredictable, the mouse will keep pushing the lever almost indefinitely, to exhaustion and death. The behavior is not confined to laboratory mice. Watch a bank of slot machines in Vegas. You'll see the same thing. The moral, people easily fall into the unconscious pursuit of dopamine and its accompanying pleasure despite the obviously illogical downside. when somebody goes on a shopping spree. It's the anticipation of that purchase that creates the dopamine, and then to keep that high, they do that again and again. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, almost always known as just a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us provide a little bit of stress short term, can enhance learning. But this time window is maybe up to about 2 hours in most studies. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means that with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy for everyone is regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. Then you can figure out strategies that are specific for various situations. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the big factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay at one position and one place get most entrenched. An example where I see this resistance in mentor coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he founded 36 years ago to his 2 children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, functions, relationships. Now, these last 2 principles, I think, are huge in strategizing change and in coaching. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. And 2 things, above all others, create neurogenesis: enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment is exactly what we do with every client: intellectual and emotional stimulation to co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bust. The hippocampus is the part of the brain that's specially connected with creativity and memory. It's in the midbrain, as you know. Mice from an enriched environment with this kind of stimulation have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And remember, the hippocampus is about creativity and memory. These findings were fairly recently replicated in non-invasive human studies in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. In a related finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus decline with chronic stress. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons, rezoning, developing cortical real estate. Here's an example. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an upside-down image consistently 24 hours a day. So they had to adjust everything they did to think it through, because up was down, down was – they had to reverse everything. Then about day 25, they each noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. Their brains had rewired. They didn't need to do the careful thinking and movement anymore. The brains had developed new neural pathways. Another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. So when we write a new story, change our minds, we change our brains. And this emphasizes the importance of consistency. Step 5, map changes. A man approached, this is a true story, approached J.P. Morgan, held up an envelope, and said, "Sir, in my hand, I hold a guaranteed formula for success, which I'll gladly sell you for $25,000. And over a century ago, that was a bunch of money. I mean, it still is. I got $7 in my pocket, I think. That still is a lot of money. Sir, J.P. Morgan said, I don't know what's in the envelope. However, if you show it to me and I like it, I'll give you my word as a gentleman that I'll pay you what you ask. Well, considering the options, the man agreed to the terms, handed over the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single piece of paper, read it quickly, and handed the piece of paper back to the man. Wrote him a check for $25,000. There were two sentences on that page. Every morning, write a list of the things that need to be done that day. Do them. So there are six crucial elements to map change. We'll talk about how to understand and incorporate each of the six, which is an outline to master and change a money story. One, regulate states of mind. Now, we've talked about that and talked about how important it is to be grounded and centered so that we have access to all of the information in all of our states of mind. Because states of mind are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determine how we perceive and how we process information and then respond. And we each have a set of different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention. A key element is to be aware of the different states of mind and know which state works best for what purpose. In other words, to do deliberate practice to create optimum performance. For example, creative writing and editing, two very different states of mind, two different parts of the brain that need to be determined and planned and structured rather than going back and forth, and put into a configuration of biorhythms of when you're most creative, when you know, the various things that can frame it in a way that make it make sense. So when someone's in an emotional state, they may be overbalanced toward right brain response, the feeling brain. In an extreme stress, the emotional brain hijacks the intellectual logical brain and holds it hostage. So the first order of business is always to regulate states of mind. State always comes first in every coaching, engagement, and exchange, then strategy and story. Then you can respond when your state of mind is balanced. The number two element to map change is the powers in the focus. This is the neuroscience and quantum physics behind the law of attraction. Thoughts have a frequency and energy field. Focus selects that frequency. It's like all the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available, but we choose the channel, the frequency we want, out of hundreds of possibilities. And we each transmit and receive a frequency through our thoughts. So if you want to change something in your life, change the frequency, the channel. Now, if you think about what you don't want, it keeps showing up over and over. Now, according to quantum physics, we each generate energy frequencies or vibrations. We project energy in our emotions and thoughts that are the source of what and who we attract, as well as the basis of our sense of well-being. The quantum Zeno effect says the mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. With consistent focus and repetition, these chemical links actually become stable changes in the brain structure. The brain rewires. I had the originator of this theory in a mastermind group, a neuroscientist at UCLA. So quantum physics offers us still another paradigm. In addition to our individual energy field, there's a collective field. Einstein called this the unified field theory. Basically, he said that we are each, as an individual, a bundle of energy that interacts with another person's energy field, they being a bundle of energy, as well as the collective field of a group. This is how we can read people, focus our choices, determine the flow of our future. And it's, I think, an example of, I think, a natural experiment for this. is the NBA. Teams that play away lose almost twice as many games as they do at home, regardless of their ranking, and likewise win almost twice as many at home. The positive energy feel of 50, 60, 70,000 people is huge. I'll tell you if we have time about how I do a demo of that in a workshop, in a retreat. So this concept offers explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus is more effective than a problem focus. First of all, it's going in the right direction. And when you ask a question, you align the energy field of the brain to focus together on a particular issue. And your unconscious doesn't register positive or negative, just the focus. It's kind of like a print is the same image. Your unconscious is that image. So the power of focus is whatever you attend to or focus on, you align yourself to create. So be sure you focus on the right thing. Here are some bad examples. I want to get out of debt. Focus is on debt. I want to lose weight. Focus is on overweight. And here's one that's kept a lot of dry cleaners busy. I want to be really careful and not spill anything on this new outfit. Three, visualize changes. Visualization can actually rewire the brain, can create a success image to live into. And affirmations are the story that can support that. The prototype study that began a number of much more recent and much more sophisticated studies, basketball players at Ohio State were divided into three groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. One group, 30 minutes each day. And the third group, they practiced imagining shooting perfect free throws, nothing but net, at least 5 minutes for 30 days. Now, they were tested at the end of 30 days. First group, no practice, no improvement. Second group, actual practice, 30 minutes daily, 24% improvement. Third group, visualization only, 23% improvement. And subsequent studies have shown that visualization only can improve over actual performance, because with actual performance, each time you miss, you have to correct that and look at, you know, practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent. So that's why perfect practice can make a better kind of permanence. So visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea, that the experience changes the brain. So the vision serves as guide and inspiration, then to design ways to realize it, to live into it. Four, insight changes the brain. At the instant of insight, an aha experience, three different parts of the brain light up on an fMRI scan. And at that moment, someone is vaulted into a state of mind that's more synthetic and creative and integrative. Compare that to when someone is given facts, information, a directive, an order. Nothing happens. So this insight-induced change is important, but it's the sustained attention and systematic plan that both hardwires it and creates a successful action. Five, take action. The world will not pay you for what you know. It pays you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important, but payday comes, as you know, with action. Winners develop a plan, set it into motion. It may not be perfect, but they self-correct and keep moving forward, learning from their mistakes, and produce results. And six, transform identity. A new experience or idea must be focused on consistently and frequently. When attention is consistent, brain circuitry becomes stabilized. The mindset of identity then can incorporate the new experiences and integrate them as part of an evolving self, as a component of a transforming identity. And we'll talk more about this next time. This is the P of the roadmap. Otherwise, it's not integrated and prone to be dismissed as not me or attributed to luck or circumstance. And we're going to talk, as I mentioned, program new identity, step seven, much more next time. So here's a kind of an application of steps four and five to decide and map change focused on your debt story. You can fulfill a desire you didn't know you had by spending money you don't have. You can define yourself by acquisitions not paid for. You can even borrow based on how much money you'll be lended rather than how much money you can pay back. Spending money can generate the perception, both by the spender and the observer, of having money. Fulfilling a wish can create the desire. When desires become identity, the quest can become unrelenting. Many people who fall heavily into debt do not necessarily have psychological problems, but because spending takes on a life of its own. With spending, the chase is on. They then try to afford what they buy, and money can never buy what it represents emotionally. My first client as a mentor coach revealed to me after about 3 months of coaching that she secretly had a debt of over $500,000 that even her husband didn't know about, and she was a recognized specialist in a field that would be doubly embarrassing if people were to know it. So debt can be a real shameful secret. It's hard to say because the way our minds and our brains are wired, it's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying. It activates the same pleasure center in the brain that releases dopamine. Spending money can be addictive. It changes the state of mind. And it's difficult to substitute a theory, future need, long-term saving, retirement, for the immediate. The most common ways we're short-sighted in our decision-making is that we may choose a small amount of something right now rather than a larger amount in the future. So here are some possibilities, and these are kind of a summary from a number of different areas of research. Neuroeconomist Ben Seymour at University College in London has shown that imagining a future purchase has the same effect as the brain getting it. Saving is easier when it's for something specific that we can envision for a specific goal. Another, tangibly calculate the cost of debt so that it becomes real figures. Another, concretely represent the magic of compound interest. Figure out what the money you spend would be worth in 5 years, in 10 years, at retirement. An example, investing $1.50 a day beginning at age 20, based on the stock market average growth since 1926, by age 65 would be worth $1 million. Wait 1 year until age 21 instead of 20 to start that. The difference is $109,000. Another, investing $2,000 a year in an IRA beginning at 18 and then stopping all investment by age 30. By age 65, be worth $1 million. Another, as I mentioned, one plan, automatically deduct retirement savings each month. And think about, we touched on this, but think about how credit cards segment this pleasure of spending, located in a specific part of the brain, the anticipation of spending, from future payment. The future payment activates a totally different part of the brain, that is the insula, that's activated with social disgust. So rationalization heightens in proportion to elastic boundaries. That's why people will spend 23% more using a credit card than they will paying cash or check. Because, well, you know, the buying is segmented from paying. Well, paying's next month. We don't have to think about that for a while. I'm going to have some more money next month. At least tomorrow's another day. And a recent economic study showed that credit card holders are consciously aware of only $4 of every $10 they owe. Now, that was surprising even to me, because it would seem like you'd have a ballpark idea. Now, so I want to conclude with what one expert had to say about this. This was Uncle Junior to his nephew, Tony Soprano. You know, your father and me started that poker game over 30 years ago. We were talking one day about how the credit card companies, you know, they work their angle, how they don't care what you bought as long as they don't pay all at once. As long as you don't pay all at once. They juice you to death, and you thank them for letting you have a card. You'd rather be juiced than pay all at once. It's a certain kind of player. That's why they call it the executive game. So we render money in abstraction and deceive ourselves. Well, I can do it on my credit card, so it won't be an immediate expense. And as Richard Medley said, free money makes you stupid. Now, remember, a final word here, and then I want to get questions and comments. Remember this from everything you've heard in this seminar right now. Saving and the future are both abstractions. There will be a time when they both become very real. Okay, we're in discussion now mode now. If you'll manage the background noise and come off of mute when you have a question or a comment, I'm eager to hear what you have to say or ask. Remember the background noise. Everybody be on mute until you're ready to talk, because I love dogs, but not right now. Questions, comments, thoughts? I'm very eager to hear your comments.
This is Bonita. Can you hear me?
David,
go ahead, Bonita, and then we'll come back.
Hi. I loved what you – I had a very real experience of what you were saying, and it really came from a previous seminar. The making one decision can make a difference. I historically had had a problem way in the past of saving. And then 2 years ago – was it your – yeah, about 2 years ago, a motivation to save for my granddaughter, I made a decision to put – $500 away. It was one decision. It was a decision, you know, just make one decision and leave it. And when I looked in the account, of course, now she has $18,000 towards her college fund.
Wow, congratulations. That's terrific.
Yeah, it was just one decision. And when you said that today, it just reminded me of that one decision.
Uh-huh.
It was just a card. Baby
school, yeah.
Amazing. I need a management of the background noise so that we can focus here. Can you do the background noise, please, and mute star six? There was a guy who was about to make a comment. Will you jump
in? Oh, yes.
I'll put us on lecture mode as soon as you say it, because we've got some background problems.
Yep. Yes, David, go on here. I was thinking about the debt. How I was getting into credit card debt, because I was talking to a client about their credit card, and I know they needed the money, but they weren't saving for their kids' costs and that, for their school and all the rest of it. So I said to them, don't worry about the credit card being for using it, but not for that sort of debt. Try and use it for business debt. So they can make money out of a credit card, use it as a vehicle. And so I had to coach their thinking into using debt for a good reason, not for it took probably just that 1 hour to talk through that. And so they did. They started cancelling all their debt as quickly as they could, and just using it now. They got three credit cards, and they're using it for just business now. And that decision happened just like the way you said it. It was a mindset, eh? Just to change their mind that they're not going to use credit for their normal costs, eh? It had to be for a better reason. So that was a mindset change that I thought came quite swiftly. I didn't realize how quickly it was going to come. But, the idea that they did do it in the end, it was quite mind-blowing for me, because I thought they were going to be stuck on their habits for a long time. But
okay, I put us on lecture mode to respond. Thank you for that example. It's a great example, and it's an example of creating a system and having a plan. And when it's more tangible like that and specific purposes or cards or specific categories, you've created a system that someone can make a judgment based on that system and sticking to the plan. So it's what investors do about having maybe two or three piles of money, one for long term, you know, one for immediate and then one for there are different ways to go about it, but you created a way that created a structure that someone can base a judgment on so that they're not at the mercy of their urge or their whim or don't have a system to decide other than dopamine. So I'm going to come off of lecture mode again if there's another question or comment. Got the same baby there. Any other questions, thoughts, or comments? I'll take it and then put us in lecture mode and do a quick response. It's out of town.
Hi, Dave. This is Catherine. I'll just say it really fast and then with that background noise. But I like the motivation. What that is. Motivation is not essential.
Right.
And there are only two things you need is planning and sticking to it. And so I'm taking a career mastery, and this is something that Deborah said, is that you do one thing a day. After a week, that's seven things. You make, you know, one change. That's seven changes. And then after a month, that's 30 changes. And so it just, it's doable is really, and I'm going to go off because I know that background noise is really bad.
Okay, well, that's a great
but
point.
It's doable.
I mean, you said it very clearly. I'll be sure and get out a note to remind them for a discussion period at the end of next seminar in a more extended way to be absolutely certain to manage it. So thank you all very, very much. I appreciate it.
Hello, are you part of the seminar? Hello, are you a part of the seminar? I don't think that person is a part of the seminar. Wow. Hello.
a minute.